Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, April 21st, 2024. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto, and we look at the front page of today's Cedar Rapids Gazette. Half of Johnson County's Latino immigrants are chronically homeless, by Elijah Decius of the Gazette in Iowa City. Sitting beneath a baptism certificate framed on the wall of her mobile home, Maria de Villa Herrera recounted the harrowing journey of how she carried her children across the Rio Grande on the nation's southern border 2 years ago. After a trek from her native Honduras to Mexico, she took the advice of those she was staying with, pursue a better life in the United States. If you don't die crossing the river, reach out to this man when you get across the border, her host said. With the help of strangers, Davila Herrera, her 10-year-old daughter clinging to her waist and her 18-year-old disabled son on her shoulders, set out across the water, a move where life was not guaranteed for anyone, let alone three. By the grace of God, we made it across, she said. Their contact in the United States delivered as promised, connecting her family to a mobile home they could share in Iowa City. Today, the family shares a 2-bedroom mobile home with two other families, a total of 12 living in a small double-wide. Together, the three families pay what they can each month to make the $1,400 rent. Davila Herrera, 46, works part-time at a shampoo factory, which gives her the flexibility to take care of her son, now 20, who has physical and developmental disabilities. Here, life is not easy, but it's a world away from where they were. From a couch in the living room where four people sleep every night, Davila Herrera described the weight that was lifted when she crossed the threshold of her new bedroom. I felt like a different woman. I smiled for the first time in a long time, she said through an interpreter. I felt liberated. And in the time since her family escaped gang violence, domestic violence, and child abuse, she's seen her daughter blossom too. With a school she enjoys, now 12-year-old Darling is helping her mother live vicariously just with her smiles. No matter how many people they share an address with, their new home will always feel larger than the place they left in Honduras, described as a jail. The world was dangerous outside, and my husband made it dangerous inside, Davila Herrera said. Living in a space designed for a single family is challenging, but the feelings of happiness and liberation are what make the three feel at home, despite the square footage. This world is for them, she said. When Tania Diaz, 28, last year escaped gangs threatening her family's life in Honduras, she found a room to share in Iowa City after the long journey. Her husband, a major source of support for the family, was detained at the border and remains in a detention facility. In a small room shared with seven others, she slept in a twin bed with her children, ages 11, 15 months, and 2 months. Other bedrooms housed multiple men and families she didn't know. Today, she lives in the Catholic Worker House, working a low-wage job to afford an immigration attorney. I'm not looking for a giant house or mansion, just a small home where me and my family can be safe, she said. We don't come from our country to be a burden. Despite having a roof over their heads, these immigrant families and many others like them in Johnson County are part of a group experiencing a technical definition of homelessness. According to a new survey involving university researchers and health officials of nearly 500 working immigrants in Iowa City and Coralville, more than half of Latino respondents live doubled up, tripled up, or quadrupled up in housing with other families and individuals. Such crowded living conditions affect Latinos disproportionately than other immigrants. The majority of the survey group, half of whom are permanent residents, pay over $800 a month for housing while earning less than $20 an hour. The Salud, Tejo y Trabajo report, released in March by Johnson County Public Health, the University of Iowa College of Nursing, and immigrant-led advocacy group Escucha Mi Voz, documents a vivid snapshot of health, housing, and work disparities among African and Latino immigrants. It is reported that 64% of survey respondents were concentrated in just 5 census tracts. 4 of those low-income neighborhoods are contiguous in Iowa City. 1 is in Coralville. But unlike people living on the streets who are counted by the annual point-in-time counts used to allocate funding for homeless resources, the people sharing small spaces with multiple families do not get counted for government resources. It is likely that the actual number of people facing homelessness in our community is more than 6 times larger than our current estimates suggest, said Manny Galvez, board member of Escucha Mi Voz. This discrepancy means that the majority of prevention funds are being directed to only a small segment of the issue. The effects of poor housing conditions go beyond a matter of comfort. Expensive, crowded, and substandard housing is one structural determinant contributing to a variety of health problems, according to the report authored by Johnson County Public Health and the UI College of Nursing. Nearly 25% of Latino respondents had at least one serious medical condition, such as asthma or diabetes. Johnson County already has a slightly higher percentage of residents who are uninsured, 5.18% compared with the state average of 4.83%. Generally, that leads to poorer health outcomes with less access to care, fewer preventive services, and less timely treatment for chronic conditions, said Carrie Shannon, community health nurse for Johnson County Public Health. Immigration status in individuals and families is understood as a key social determinant of health and serves as a critical contributor to racial health inequities, Shannon said. When our community members are forced to prioritize their legal immigration status over their health and well-being, we end up with growing food and housing insecurity, growing rates of maternal and child mortality, and much worse outcomes in areas of chronic disease and mental health. The report recommends that city and county policymakers fund more innovative community health partnerships and new permanent supportive housing developments for immigrants and refugees. Escucha Mi Voz also has implored the Johnson County Board of Supervisors to support a proposed $1.5 million affordable housing project funded by the Federal American Rescue Plan Act. If governments are truly committed to racial equity and effectively addressing homelessness, a radical reevaluation of government strategies is imperative, said Manny Galvez, a board member of Escucha Mi Voz. Supervisors who previously voiced support for the measure voted unanimously April 3rd to halt funding for the project. Previous ARPA-funded projects supported by supervisors included a $3.5 million direct assistance program that distributed $1,400 payments directly to more than 2,200 county residents who did not qualify for other federal stimulus payments. Supervisor John Green said the decision hinged on the county's inability to meet ARPA compliance requirements. That applied to the use of the funding for new projects in other areas as well, he said. If we utilize ARPA money for affordable housing in any way, we commit ourselves and future supervisors to a 20-year compliance requirement that is unique and beyond the other rules governing ARPA, Green told the Gazette. If we were a larger county, we'd already have those systems and staff in place, but we currently do not. The county has earned $1.75 million in interest from ARPA funds held in the bank awaiting use. Green said that money could be used for an affordable housing project free from the restrictions. It's my intention, and I think the intention of other supervisors, to instead use that interest income for a similarly scoped affordable housing initiative that doesn't commit supervisors to an expensive compliance burden we're not currently equipped to meet, he said. In a statement, Escucha Mi Voz said other funding sources are not a viable alternative unless they also guarantee that the project is affordable to tenants at or below 120% of the adjusted median income for 20 years. Without these guarantees, the county could claim the mantle of affordable housing while still charging market rate rent like any other landlord, the organization said. Also from the front page, Senate doesn't extend pause on casinos, opens door for Cedar Rapids to seek license for a facility, by Marissa Payne of the Gazette. Casino backers' long-held dreams to build a gambling facility in Cedar Rapids stayed alive early Saturday after the Iowa Senate didn't take up a five-year extension of a moratorium advanced by House lawmakers that would have blocked new casino licenses and tightened restrictions on new licenses awarded by beyond 2029. The gambling regulations were part of Senate File 2427 and would have again thwarted Cedar Rapids' potential third try for a gaming facility near downtown. The House passed the amendment extending the pause in a 71-21 vote and advanced the final bill, 76-16. The Senate adjourned the legislative session without considering the measure. The two-year pause lawmakers enacted in 2022 is slated to end come July. Now, Cedar Rapids will have to let the chips fall where they may. Months before lawmakers in 2022 halted new casinos, the Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission had set in motion the application process for a Linn County gaming license. The moratorium put the brakes on Cedar Rapids' third attempt after the panel rejected licenses in 2014 and 2017. The panel looked to take applications because voters in November 2021, for a second consecutive time, passed the gaming referendum in Linn County, giving Cedar Rapids the ability to seek a license in perpetuity from the state commission. But under the bill the House advanced Saturday, the number of state-licensed casinos would have been capped at 19 through June 30, 2029. Only counties with a license as of June 1, 2022 could have a license. Once that pause expired, starting July 1, 2029, the commission would have had to issue a socioeconomic study on the impact of gambling on Iowans before issuing a new gambling location license. The bill would have blocked the commission from issuing a new license for a new location that would negatively impact an existing licensee located in a county touching the Iowa border or a rural county with a population of less than 30,000. Of Iowa's 19 licensed casinos, that language applies to all except Prairie Meadows in Altoona and Isle Casino in Waterloo. That means the commission would stave off competition to the casinos in Davenport and Riverside, operated by Elite Casino Resorts, whose chief executive officer, Dan Keel, has long argued a Cedar Rapids casino would cannibalize revenue from existing properties. Cedar Rapids gaming interests have argued that while Iowa is increasingly competing with Nebraska for gaming revenues, and Elite has expanded there, now is a prime time for a casino here. Mayor Tiffany O'Donnell said the city was merely asking for the opportunity to apply for a gambling license that voters overwhelmingly wanted. "We're not asking for any special treatment," O'Donnell said. "We just want to push forward with our plans, so hopefully this means we can do that." While the two-year pause has been in effect, O'Donnell said this allowed extra time to ensure the potential casino reflects modern gaming. It would have expanded entertainment and sports betting opportunities while the popularity of online gambling threatened bricks and mortar facilities. "One of the challenges when the market is impeded, there's very little incentive for existing casinos to be innovative and evolve," O'Donnell said, "and this new facility represents the way people game today. It is an entertainment facility that happens to have gaming inside." For years, Keel has bankrolled Iowa lawmakers' campaigns, but since the pause on new casino licenses was enacted, Linn County gaming interests have started to do the same. Keel's Political Action Committee, Elite PAC, has doled out $536,050 to Iowa candidates, office holders, and both major political parties since 2016, state records show. Cedar Rapids casino backers have contributed $185,000 since its formation in 2022 of the Cedar Rapids Development Group PAC. Given Elite has funneled nearly three times that amount to Iowa politicians' campaigns over the course of six more years than Cedar Rapids casino backers, Keel has been a dominant political force. But Elite has contributed slightly less than that group, $170,500, to Iowa politicians since the Cedar Rapids PAC's creation. That accounts for campaign contributions since July 15, 2022, the beginning of the third reporting period of 2022 when Cedar Rapids gaming interests started their PAC. Since July 2022, Cedar Rapids casino backers donated $68,250 to legislative leaders, more than $52,000 Elite contributed. Local gaming interest pumped $6,250 into Bobby Kaufman's campaign account, while Elite donated $7,500. Turning to the Iowa Today and a week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state. Under the heading In the News, legislative session wrapping up. Iowa lawmakers were in the final stretch of the 2024 legislative session Friday, hoping to pass the necessary bills to adjourn for the year by Saturday. Lawmakers were considering bills funding the state government and cutting income taxes by $1 billion. The four-month legislative session was dominated by debate over a proposal from Governor Kim Reynolds to overhaul the area education agencies that provide special education support to Iowa schools. The legislature also looked at school safety, passing bills to beef up security infrastructure at schools, and create a permitting process for school staff to carry guns. RFK Jr. tries for ballot access. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the nephew of former President John F. Kennedy, held a convention in Iowa last weekend as he seeks ballot access for his independent presidential run. The candidate, who lodged an unsuccessful Democratic primary challenge to President Joe Biden, said he believes he can be a viable third-party candidate for president. Lawmakers advance pay raise. Iowa House lawmakers passed a bill last week to increase their pay by $10,000, bringing their base pay to $35,000, but it had not advanced in the Senate by Friday. Supporters of the bill said it would encourage more Iowans to run for seats in the legislature. The bill also would increase salaries for statewide officials, including the governor. DEI in education budget. Iowa Republicans moved to ban diversity, equity, and inclusion programs at Iowa's public universities for any reason other than to comply with federal or state law or accreditation standards. The proposal was added to lawmakers' education budget in the last days of the legislative session. Republicans have long attacked diversity efforts as a left-wing political ideology that increases unnecessary administrative costs. Democrats, though, have argued that they promote student success and help students from different backgrounds feel welcome. AG to administer assault services. Attorney General Brenna Byrd announced funding to set up a sexual assault support center in southeast Iowa after the University of Iowa announced it would close its rape victim advocacy center. The office is seeking applications for up to $400,000 a year to provide medical and shelter care for victims. Under the heading, They Said, by combining Iowa's 32 mental health and substance use regions into seven unified behavioral health districts, we can provide consistent services, coordinate care system-wide, and most importantly, improve outcomes for Iowans. Governor Kim Reynolds on behavioral health bill. And this allegation that universities are indoctrinating students or that there's something nefarious happening, it's just not true. And it's wrong because it really undermines the work of a lot of hardworking Iowans. Representative Adam Zabner, Democrat, Iowa City, on a bill to ban diversity, equity, and inclusion offices at universities. Under the heading Odds and Ends, Caitlin Clark Fever, Iowa Hawkeye star Caitlin Clark was selected number one overall in the WNBA draft this past week by the Indiana Fever. Clark finished her record-breaking college career this year and led the Hawkeyes to the NCAA championship game. Hawkeye Kate Martin also was selected number 18 overall by the Las Vegas Aces. Raise for judges. Iowa judges would get a 5% raise under the judicial system budget lawmakers passed this year. The bill also changes the required contribution rate for the judges' retirement system. Judicial advocate said this year that Iowa has a hard time attracting judges because of their low pay. Under the heading Water Cooler, Boy Scout Abuse Bill, Iowa lawmakers were set to pass an 11th-hour bill to allow victims of sexual abuse in the Boy Scouts of America organization to recover more money in a bankruptcy lawsuit with the organization. The bill would extend the statute of limitations for victims to sue, meeting an April 19th deadline in the case. And conservative school curriculum passes. A bill that would impose certain curriculum standards on Iowa schools, inspired by the work of a conservative political group, was sent to Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds for a signature this past week. Republican supporters said the bill will instill patriotism in Iowa students, while Democrats said it presented a one-sided view of history. Turning to the Insight page, we have a guest column from Jerry Perkins. Jerry Perkins is an Iowa native who served as a Peace Corps volunteer in Panama and Nicaragua and returned to Iowa in 1976 to raise a family with his wife, Peggy. In 1992, he was the manager of the Russian-American Agribusiness Center in Stavropol, Russia. He was a journalist at the Des Moines Register for more than 25 years and was the Register's farm editor from 1993 to 2008. This column did first appear in the Des Moines Register. Iowa generosity. Iowans have responded to international crises in the past and must step up again. From everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded, and from the one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked. Luke 12:48. Iowans have, for many years, been leaders in international outreach through agricultural assistance, disaster relief, and economic development. The list of Iowans who have lent their skills to helping others is long and includes Norman Borlaug, Henry Wallace, Herbert Hoover, Roswell Garst, and many others. Nor is the list confined to politicians and agribusinessmen. Iowa has, for many years, sent thousands of its sons and daughters to the Peace Corps. As depicted in the recent Iowa PBS documentary, Citizen Diplomacy, Iowans have responded many times in the past with generosity when confronted by an international crisis, deploying a skillful practicality for solving problems and overcoming barriers in reaching out to others in need. One Iowa-based organization, Self-Help International, has been working for more than 60 years to fight malnutrition and hunger in Ghana and Nicaragua. As a member of Self-Help's board of directors, I have seen how Self-Help promotes agricultural practices that boost agricultural yields and promotes the cultivation of crops with improved nutritional qualities to ensure that children and other family members are better fed so they can be healthier and more productive. Self-Help also provides small loans at nominal interest rates to farmers, both men and women, so they can grow improved crops such as high-protein corn to feed their families more nutritionally and sell the rest in the marketplace. Small loans are also made to female entrepreneurs who are taught business skills so they can successfully earn income that many of them use to improve their children's diets and finance their schooling. In Ghana, teen girls clubs promote educational opportunities for adolescent females. The surest way to curb population growth, it has been shown conclusively, is to educate girls. Self-Help's Growing Healthy Food, Growing Healthy Children program demonstrates that providing infants in their first 1,000 days of life with an adequate diet is vital in promoting health and success in life. In Nicaragua, Self-Help provides communities with chlorine tablets to purify their water supply, staving off waterborne diseases. Community leaders in other parts of Ghana and Nicaragua have seen what Self-Help has accomplished and reached out to the organization to expand. When people ask you to work with them, you know you are doing something right. An important element in Self-Help's success is that the organization's staff members are all, respectively, Ghanaians and Nicaraguans. A small staff of four people runs the organization's Iowa headquarters, keeping administrative costs low and providing ample bang for the buck for Self-Help's donors. The time has come for Iowans to follow the lead of Self-Help International and other Iowa-based international organizations to ramp up their efforts to promote increased agricultural production in Africa, Central America, and other parts of the world where children go to bed hungry, stunted by a lack of adequate nutrition. The ramifications of that stunting are many and are compounded by a changing climate, government corruption, religious conflict, and organized criminal activities. There are many ways Iowans can continue our state's proud history of helping those in need. For example, Iowans with a background in agronomy could boost agricultural production in Central America and Africa, where corn and beans are staples of the human diet. Or Iowans with experience in the grain industry could show farmers living in tropical climates how to preserve their harvests from pestilence and spoilage. These are but two examples of the types of expertise that Iowans could lend to people living in countries in need of assistance. An Iowa outreach corps should not be restricted to those with a specialized skill. We all have our areas of interest and expertise. There are many ways Iowans can continue our state's proud history of helping those in need. Dedicated volunteers from all walks of life can contribute. Furthermore, businesses will find that loaning some of their employees to an international endeavor will add experience and knowledge to those employees that can't be acquired anywhere else. Living and working in a foreign country can be incredibly enriching. The primary skill needed is an open mind. As the quote from the Bible that precedes this article says, those of us who have been fortunate enough to live in Iowa should become citizen diplomats in extending our good fortune to others. We Iowans should feel blessed that we have been given so much because of the lucky happenstance of living in this land of plenty. The verse from Luke says to me that we should give back as much, if not more, than we have been given. But just feeling blessed doesn't necessarily prod one to reach out to others who have not been as fortunate as we have been. Reaching out, spending time, money, and whatever skills we possess to boost the economic well-being of others also needs to come from a recognition that what improves the lives of our brothers and sisters around the world improves our lives as well. As John F. Kennedy once said, those who make peaceful change impossible make violent revolution inevitable. Those who make peaceful change impossible make violent revolution inevitable. I have firsthand knowledge of the accuracy of this quote because, as a Peace Corps volunteer working and living in Nicaragua in 1971 to 72, I witnessed the Somoza family's dynasty's five-decade-long reign of autocracy and kleptocracy. The appalling poverty in Nicaragua was a result of the Somoza family's misrule and led, just as Kennedy said it would, to a violent revolution in 77-78 that killed an estimated 50,000 people. A U.S. finance proxy war that followed the revolution killed still more. Peaceful change wasn't possible in Nicaragua, so violent revolution was inevitable. Wars caused by poverty and desperation also inevitably lead to consequences that reach across borders and oceans to affect all of us. The tragic circumstances occurring at our southern border and in the countries bordering the Mediterranean show just how desperate people can be. Helping prevent wars and violent revolutions in each of our best interests. When we lend a helping hand to others, we are also helping ourselves. That kind of enlightened self-interest should guide us in all we do as Iowans to help others help themselves. So let's band together as Iowans in our state's long and proud tradition and reach out to the world in need. We have much to give. Let's start right away. Althea Cole writes in her To a Candid World column, 25 years after Columbine horror, school shootings still happen. It was difficult to watch the April 20th, 1999 surveillance footage from the school cafeteria at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado. The area shown in the video looks unnervingly similar to the lower commons at Linmar High School, where I would lunch with friends and socialize before school during my 4 years as a student there, which started that same school year. But in this video, the students aren't sitting at lunch tables. They're crouched beneath them while a staff member speaks into a radio and motions for everyone to stay down. Moments later, the students stand up en masse and proceed frantically out of the area. Like most surveillance videos at the time, there's no sound. That's likely a good thing. The silent, blurry version is chilling enough in the way it depicts the first moments when hundreds of teenagers realize that several of their fellow students are being gunned down right outside. After beginning outside, the two shooters, themselves Columbine students, enter the school to continue their rampage. Using guns that were illegally obtained and illegally modified, they killed a total of 12 of their fellow students and one teacher before committing suicide in the corner of the same school library where they had slaughtered 9 of their peers. They had spent almost a year preparing for their killing spree. Their original plan was for the homemade pipe bombs hidden in duffel bags they had placed among other backpacks in the cafeteria to detonate just as the cafeteria was full of students. The bombs were set with timers to detonate at 11:17 a.m. It is believed they intended to wait in the parking lot and shoot any surviving students while they fled the cafeteria, with additional bombs in their cars set to detonate afterward. When none of the bombs detonated, the assailants moved closer to the building and began shooting. Were it not for faulty wiring and shoddy construction of the homemade bombs, the death toll could have reached into the hundreds. The carnage would have been unspeakable. Yesterday was the 25th anniversary of the Columbine Massacre. To many U.S. adults, the name Columbine is part of our lexicon, not only as the event itself, but as one synonymous with any mass shooting. It wasn't the first at a K-12 school in U.S. history, but it was the worst at the time, and it was the first in the age of both cable TV and home internet. Those characteristics earned the Columbine Massacre unprecedented media coverage. At one point, up to 500 reporters and 90 satellite trucks were on scene, parsing every piece of information they could find. To this day, troves of documents from the FBI investigation and the Jefferson County Sheriff's report remain accessible online. Even after incidents with higher death tolls, many of us remember Columbine not only as the momentous event in which we came to terms with the indiscriminate killing of kids, but also as the one that generated theories about a school culture of bullying and of potential accomplices who were part of the sinister Trenchcoat Mafia. It ignited the ne'er-settled debate over gun culture and gun control. That debate continues today. It will never cease. To people my age, Columbine was a momentous event in our lives because we, too, were kids in school. I was in ninth grade during the 1998-99 school year. Even without smartphones and social media, hardly any of us even had one of those fancy flip phones, news of the shooting had made its way to Lynn Mar High School within an hour or two. I remember what class I was in when the school principal took the intercom system to offer words of assurance to the student body about our safety and security. The shooting hadn't happened to us, but reality was about to change for all of us. I wrote about the awful news of Columbine High School in the pages of my teenage diary that week, making notes of how it probably wasn't a coincidence that they did it on that jerk Hitler's birthday. The words are tucked in a rose-patterned notebook adorned with stickers, nestled between mentions of cute boys, an English test, and my blue ribbon-earning performance at the recent piano festival. I was 14 years old. Every teenager should have a chance to be a teenager. It was 25 years ago that the families of 15 people learned that their loved one was dead. One was a teacher with a wife, kids, and grandkids. 12 were students slain by fellow students. 2 were the perpetrators, their parents grief peppered with the reality that their teenage sons had murdered their own peers. 25 years ago, yesterday. It was 25 years ago today that the parents of 13 million high schoolers sent their sons and daughters to school knowing that teenagers can be cold-blooded killers. Most of my peers who were teenagers in 1999 now have children of their own in school. I do not. Some even have teenagers older now than we were when Columbine happened. They're attending school in a world where mass shootings are just as tragic but somehow less shocking as the names of more schools and communities are written in the history books. Since Columbine, our world has evolved to the point where any person can broadcast every thought and feeling they have to the whole world. After a violent tragedy happens, the loudest chorus of public opinion is often quick to lay blame, believing that our advanced and enlightened society already has the means to prevent it from happening, and our failure to do so is blood on our hands. That evil simply exists in our world is one of the most incredibly difficult things a human being can ever accept or acknowledge. It offers no comfort, no satisfaction, and no understanding. For many, it's easier to demand legislative and executive action to prevent the next shooting. But when focusing solely on prevention, it's easy to forget that law and policy is never applied with precision. Preventive measures are a sieve, a filter on society, if you will, with the duty to both identify and catch what is dangerous while leaving what is not undisturbed. It's virtually, if not literally, impossible to get it precise. Take red flags on mental health, for example. If society's filter is too sparse, behavioral signs that beg intervention slip through unaddressed. If the filter is too dense, a person's privacy is imperiled, their civil and constitutional rights trampled, and their trust is lost. Every state in the nation has laws restricting firearm possession for people with mental illness. Similar laws also exist at the federal level. Many times, the law fails to keep dangerous weapons out of the hands of unstable people. Sometimes it's because the law lacks clarity for enforcement, and sometimes it's because a person's determination to use a firearm outweighs their willingness to follow the law. The idea behind the recent school security bill signed by Governor Kim Reynolds on Friday is that intervention can save lives when prevention hasn't worked. House File 2586 will require school districts with 8,000 or more students to employ either a school resource officer or a private security officer to guard each building in its district where students in grades 9 through 12 attend, unless the school board votes to opt out. If the district opts for a private security guard, the security official would need to take annual live scenario training and quarterly live firearms training through the state's Department of Public Safety. Districts with fewer than 8,000 students won't be required to retain security guard or school resource officer, but they still will be encouraged to do so. The bill also offers qualified immunity from civil or criminal liability should damage be incurred from the reasonable use of force on the job. In other words, a school resource officer or security guard wouldn't be able to use a firearm in just any circumstance, especially without liability. But in the extremely unlikely event that a person entered a school with intent to act in a lethal manner, this new law allows the school to have a trained, certified, responsible person ready in place to use force in a manner that could save lives. School shooting deaths remain incredibly rare. In 2022, Northeastern University criminologist James Fox put the odds that a child will die in a mass shooting at about 10 million to 1. But when they happen, they can happen anywhere. We were reminded of that in Iowa earlier this year. Barely 2 months after the tragic shooting at Perry High School in Perry, an Iowa poll showed that 65% of parents with school-age kids support armed security in schools. Sometimes anywhere ends up being here. An idyllic community near Denver, Colorado, learned that devastating truth a quarter century ago, and it altered reality for everyone across the country. Today it's our kids wanting to stay safe. Yesterday it was us. Looking at the community letters and today's editorial cartoon from Mike Lukovich, a syndicated cartoonist distributed by Creators Syndicate. It's a two-panel cartoon. The first panel, a woman who is labeled MTG, as in Marjorie Taylor Greene, says, after a long day spouting pro-Russian talking points, and in the second panel, it's a caricature of Vladimir Putin removing makeup and the blonde wig, saying, it's nice to remove my makeup. The first letter is from Barb Ferris of Hiawatha. Denim not enough to support victims. After reading the guest column from Republican Secretary of State Paul Pate in the Gazette about supporting sexual assault victims, I wasn't sure whether to laugh or cry. Does Pate and, frankly, the entire Republican Party in Iowa really think wearing denim for one day of the year will make a difference to these young women who have been raped or been a victim of incest? Beyond ignorant. What will help is reinstating the Plan B pill program, which Attorney General Brenna Byrd is lying about when she says it's under audit. I really hope Iowans wake up and educate themselves on what the Republicans, under the threat from the far-right white Christian nationalists at the Heritage Foundation and their Project 2025, have planned for this country. Here's a hint. It wants to take women back 50 years and keep them barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen. But no worries about those rape victims. Your friends in the Republican Party will protect you with their Levi's. Barb Ferris of Hiawatha. Next, Margaret Bartlett of Cedar Rapids writes, Trump wants to answer to no one. Voters should think carefully before putting former President Donald Trump back in the White House. His statements reveal he's an authoritarian and will surround himself with yes people whose loyalty is not necessarily to the Constitution, but to him. I've heard him say he trusts only one person, himself. No human being has perfect judgment every time. That's why the Founding Fathers made it a government of, by, and for the people. Retribution is what he indicates a second term will be about. When narcissists begin suffering the results of their own actions, they call it persecution and act like a victim to get people on their side. That's not persecution, it's reaping what they've sown. He thinks he's comparable to Christ, but his speech and actions contradict much Christ said. Christ wouldn't hurl the F word in campaign speeches or lie about visiting a murdered woman's family. Trump did. When he ran in 2016, I watched an occasion where a group was asking him questions. Afterward, as the group was breaking up, he said, "We're going to change the way we do government." I think this is one time he can be believed. Listening to him now, it's becoming more apparent that he wants a government where essentially one man, surrounded by handpicked puppets, rules. Now he wants complete immunity so he can do as he pleases, answer to no one, and get away with it. No one should be above the law, including him. Margaret Bartlett of Cedar Rapids. Next, Steve Vasey of Ames writes, petition submitted to EPA for drinking water. The Iowa Environmental Council has submitted a Safe Drinking Water Act petition to the Environmental Protection Agency, a cry for help for well owners in northeast Iowa drinking unsafe water. In 1988, the driftless counties in northeast Iowa were just beginning to feel the effects of industrialized agriculture's voracious appetite to feed emerging ethanol and CAFO industries. Corn, bean, and continuous corn cropping practices exploded. But in 1988, DNR and other Iowa scientists were not yet muzzled. That's when the study, Groundwater Contamination and Land Management in the Karst Area of Northeast Iowa, was published. The first paragraph of the abstract states, a statistical analysis of existing Northeast Iowa water quality data showed that systematic non-point contamination of groundwater quality was occurring in regional carbonate aquifers. Agricultural practices were judged to be the source of the contaminants. Let no one pretend nitrate contamination of Iowa's karst aquifers was unknown. The cause was unknown. The solutions to the problems were unknown. Statements to the contrary by government and industry spokesmen are mendacious. There are dozens of completely on-point Iowa-specific research papers dealing with this issue, most published before the academic noose tightened and funding for this topic became taboo. Nitrate causes cancer, according to multiple studies. Will the recent revelation that Iowa is second in the nation in cancers and the only state where the cancer rate is increasing be a wake-up call to the public? As much as we reject government intrusion, is it time for EPA to use its big stick? Steve Vasey of Ames. The final letter is from Linda Bendixson of Hiawatha. Beethoven Lives Upstairs struck chord. I attended Orchestra Iowa's Beethoven Lives Upstairs on April 6th. I was overwhelmed with the entire production. The Orchestra Iowa School had several fun, free activities for kids of all ages, including adults. Kids could hold and play various instruments. Then it was on to see the production, which was a fabulous telling of the story of Beethoven's life. Our orchestra accompanied the storytellers with Beethoven's music. I learned a lot about him. I didn't know he was deaf. How in the world did he compose such fantastic music without hearing? It lasted only 1 hour, which seemed like 1 minute. Kids in the audience and adults never grew restless. If you missed this wonderful event, please watch for the next one. Linda Bendixson of Hiawatha. A few quotes of the week. Representative Gary Moore, a Republican from Bettendorf, speaking in favor of a measure that would raise state elected officials' pay by $10,000. Representative Moore says, "If we truly want to attract a quality of people to be in the legislature that's cross-representative of Iowans, that was what we want, I think we need to raise that salary." Lucy Olson, a guard who is transferring from Villanova to the Iowa women's basketball team, explaining her experience when a tornado warning was issued for Iowa City. She said, "I'm not used to that in Pennsylvania. We hunkered down in the locker room until the warning ended." Representative Steve Holt, Republican Denison, speaking in favor of a bill requiring public schools to adopt new social studies and civic standards written by a conservative group, Civics Alliance. Representative Holt says, "We cannot and will not let our great American experiment fail. And one of the ways we can do that is to ensure that our children are taught the blessings of liberty. I think it is past time to emphasize to our children American character and the founding values that built this country." And Alicia Vasto, water program manager for the Iowa Environmental Council, speaking for one of the 13 groups that filed the petition with the EPA on Tuesday, urging the agency to step in to protect drinking water from runoff. Vasto says, "The Environmental Protection Commission has once again proven who they really serve, not the Iowa public, but big ag polluters." You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, April 21st, 2024, on the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. I am your reader, Sharon Faldudo, and we turn to the obituaries. From Central City, Gerald Grant Rundle, age 65, died April 18th. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion, entrusted with arrangements. Ellen Barth of Cedar Rapids passed away on December 16, 2023. In a memory of Ellen Barth, there will be a memorial mass and luncheon to follow at St. Pius X Church, 4949 Council Street Northeast, in Cedar Rapids on May 4th at 10:30 a.m. Bernice Mae Jordan, age 98, of the Albernette area, passed away at her home on April 17th. Per her request, Bernice was cremated. Celebration of life will be held in July. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Central City is assisting the family. Bernice loved taking care of her flowers, gardening, fishing, camping, and watching RFD. She was a member of the Troy Mills American Legion Auxiliary and the Red Hat Society. John Michael Schick, age 75, of Cedar Rapids, passed away April 16th at St. Luke's Hospital. Rosary, 4 to 4:30, Friday, April 26th at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service in Cedar Rapids. Visitation, 4:30 to 7, Friday, April 26th at the Funeral Home. Funeral Mass, 10 a.m. Saturday, April 27th at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids. Burial, St. John's Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. John served in the United States Naval Reserve for 23 years, including active duty in Vietnam. He retired from the Navy with the rank of Chief Equipment Operator. John was a member of IUOE Local 234 for 17 years. He was a heavy equipment operator for the Linn County Solid Waste Agency for 24 years. John was a faithful member of Immaculate Conception Catholic Church. John was a member of several veterans associations, including 40 and 8 for 50 years, and the Cedar Rapids VFW. Kenny Miller of Cedar Rapids, a party for Kenny, will be held April 27th from 12 p.m. to 3 p.m. at IBEW Local 405 Hall, 1211 Wiley Boulevard Southwest, in Cedar Rapids. Fellow electricians, family, and friends are welcomed and encouraged. Kenny wasn't a fan of funeral-related phrases, so come eat, drink, and be merry, and share plenty of memories and have fun. David Teed, 64, of Lamarck, Texas, formerly of Palo, died December 26, 2023. Graveside service is 1:30 p.m. April 27th in the Palo Cemetery in Palo. Family and friends may gather at the Palo American Legion, Post 679, 114 Vinton Street, following the service. Judy Eileen Zaruba, age 74, of Cedar Rapids, passed away April 16th at her home. A memorial service will be held 11 a.m. Friday, April 26th, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. Judy studied Taekwondo and was a seventh-degree black belt. She was a beacon of love and strength in our lives, and her memory will forever live in our hearts. Phyllis Louetta Tyne, age 85, of Summerfield, North Carolina, passed away peacefully at home with family by her side on February 5, 2024, after a long illness. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, April 27th, at the Bowen Camp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Manchester, with visitation 1 hour prior to the service. A live stream of the funeral service may be accessed on the funeral home website. Phyllis worked as a lab technician in Quality Assurance Laboratory at Procter & Gamble in Greensboro, North Carolina for many years, retiring in 2000. Phyllis was full of life, spunky, and loved to make people laugh. She loved to go dancing to the big bands in her early days and enjoyed her country music. She was an awesome cook, kept a garden and canned fresh vegetables her whole life, and always wanted to share her recipes. John Vincent Fay of Anamosa passed away of natural causes on April 8th at his home. He was 68. Throughout his life, John savored his Irish heritage. He pursued organic farming with draft horses and developed exceptional carpentry and woodworking skills. He enjoyed nature, riding and playing music, good food and drinks with friends, and the good Lord who made it all possible. His celebration of life will be Memorial Day, May 27th, from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Stone City General Store. All who knew him are welcome. Carl Allen Martins, age 74, of Strawberry Point, formerly of Edgewood, passed away on April 19th at the Edgewood Convalescent Home as a result of cancer. Funeral service, 11 a.m. Tuesday, April 23rd, at Trinity Methodist Church in Edgewood, with Reverend Mary Green officiating. Visitation, 9 to 11 a.m. Tuesday, April 23rd, at Trinity Methodist Church in Edgewood. Interment, Hopkinton Cemetery in Hopkinton, Iowa. Jacqueline Carney, age 88, of Cedar Rapids, passed away April 17th at Northbrook Care Center. Services will be held Tuesday, April 23rd, 11 a.m. at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Visitation beginning 1 hour prior to the service at the chapel. Burial, Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Jackie loved spending time with her dogs, gardening, was a great cook, enjoyed spending family times with nieces and nephews. Joseph Lee Steepleton, a native of Cedar Rapids, passed peacefully at Our Lady of Peace Hospice in St. Paul, Minnesota on January 17th. A memorial service and celebration of life will be held Saturday, April 27th, beginning at 11 a.m. until 2 p.m. at the Knights of Columbus Hall at 1620 E Avenue Northeast. Over the course of a nearly 40-year career, Joe served as both a teacher and administrator for Catholic schools, including as principal of his alma mater, LaSalle High School, until its close in 1998. In 2011, after many moves together, he and his wife landed in Austin, Minnesota, closer to their daughter. Later in life, Joe found a new vocation and joy in writing. To date, he has published 26 novels, which can be found on Amazon. In his last months, Joe expressed no fear of death and said he has no regrets. True to form, one of the last things he ate was a cup of strawberry ice cream. He always said, "Everything looks better after ice cream." Kim Hollingsworth of Cedar Rapids, born 1953 and passed 2024, was a hardworking, giving brother, son, and uncle who put the needs of others in front of his own. He was born in Tokyo, Japan, and graduated Jefferson High School in 1971. He completed his master's degree at the University of Iowa and then joined the West Liberty Police, served as sheriff deputy in Boulder, Colorado, and returned to Cedar Rapids for his true passion, coaching girls softball at Prairie, Kennedy, Linn County Cougars, and others. Kim was very proud of his military father, Marvin, and no services are listed. Marlene Chapman, age 91, of Hopkinton, passed away on April 16th at the Good Neighbor Home in Manchester following an extended illness. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, April 23rd, at St. Luke Catholic Church in Hopkinton, with interment to follow in the Hopkinton Cemetery. A parish vigil service will commence the visitation at 4 p.m. Monday, April 22nd, at the church. Visitation will conclude at 7 p.m. Monday evening and resume at 9:30 a.m. Tuesday morning until the service time. Getch Funeral Home in Monticello is entrusted with arrangements. Marlene worked for Collins Radio right after high school, and then she and her husband operated Double D Trucking out of Sand Springs. Marlene served as jailer for Delaware County for 20 years, retiring in 2010. Marlene cherished baking cookies and brownies for her grandchildren, family, and friends. She also acted as the designated grandma taxi for her grandkids until they could drive. In 1999, Marlene fulfilled her lifelong dream of traveling to Australia and New Zealand. Dennis L. Hamilton, age 82, of rural Stockton, Illinois, passed away peacefully April 9th at his home with his wife by his side. After serving in the Air Force, Dennis earned a master's degree in hospital administration from Trinity University. He was vice president of Columbus Hospital in Chicago, chief operating officer at West Suburban Hospital in Oak Park, then president and CEO of Freeport Health Network from 96 to 2005 when he retired. Golf, fly fishing, fly tying, and establishing a hardwood tree farm kept him busy in retirement. No services listed. Robert Edwin Shearer, known as Ed, age 92, of Columbia, Missouri, passed away peacefully surrounded by family and friends on April 16th at Boone Hospital. A celebration of Ed's life is being planned for this summer in Cedar Rapids. Details will be updated when they become available. Ed had a career with Square D, where he made many lifelong friendships. He enjoyed fishing, camping, boating, spending time at the cabin with his grandkids. He enjoyed traveling, going on cruises, and eating good food. He enjoyed country music all his life, and in his later years, through the influence of a friend, he came to appreciate classical music as well. On December 2, 2023, Gary Nathaniel Haster of Cedar Rapids reached his lifelong goal. He entered into heaven and met his Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, and his younger brother, Johnny. Visitation will be from 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday, April 27th at Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, located at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. A celebration of life will begin at 11 a.m. Saturday with military honors to follow. Turning to the sports page, Iowa Spring Football Analysis, Passing Game Struggles Without McNamara, Anderson, and Others by John Stepp of the Gazette. Literally, Iowa's football open Saturday was brisk. Not sure what happened to the 50-degree forecast, Iowa coach Kirk Ferentz said at the beginning of his news conference following the practice in 40-degree weather. Metaphorically, the practice included some rays of sunshine along with some brisk reminders of the work that still needs to happen between now and the start of the 2024 season. We've made some progress and seen a lot of guys grow, Ferentz said. Here are seven observations from the Hawkeyes' open practice. Motion, more motion. Saturday's open practice served as the first look at the scheme that offensive coordinator Tim Lester has been implementing this spring. He said last week about 85% of the playbook is in at this point in the year. The scheme, which included a healthy mix of 11 and 12 personal groupings, most notably had a heavy dose of pre-snap motions. What Iowa showed Saturday, April 20th, in front of fans and media, is not necessarily representative of everything that will opposing defenses will see on August 31st and beyond. It took me 13 practices to really understand the run fits, linebacker Jay Higgins said. They just do so much. They keep it simple today. Smart guys. There's probably somebody in here with a camera. Still the passing game. Cade McNamara was limited to individual drills as he continues to recover from knee surgery, and the absence of Iowa's QB1 was evident during 11-on-11 drills. Deacon Hill, who took first-team reps in McNamara's absence, threw two interceptions and was dangerously close to a few more interceptions. The second interception was intended for running back Max White on a short route, but Hill's throw was behind White and went off his outstretched hand. Marco Lanez, who has taken second-team reps this spring, showed the ability to extend plays with his feet on Saturday. But when it came to actually throwing, Lanez had mixed results. Ferentz, when asked afterward about the passing game on display Saturday, recalled a play when Hill's pass sailed over wide receiver Caden Wetchin's head. The throw was off by about 2 feet, something like that, Ferentz said. That, to me, was like kind of where we're at right now. In the fall, we got to make that play. Linebacker depth. Iowa's first-team linebacker core, consisting of the veteran trio of Higgins, Nick Jackson, and Kyler Fisher, carries a high level of formidability. Saturday's open practice was a reminder of how formidable the Hawkeyes' second-team linebacker core is as well. Carson Sherrar was responsible for Hill's first interception, had a tackle for loss, and nearly grabbed a second interception as well. Jackson Rexroth, a former Cedar Rapids Xavier standout, also had an interception in Saturday's open practice, which he returned for a touchdown. Some injuries, but not too serious. Fisher, wide receiver Seth Anderson, safety Cohen Entringer, cornerback Jermari Harris, defensive lineman Yahya Black, offensive tackle Gennings Dunker, and tight end Addison Ostranga were among the players not in uniform. Center Logan Jones also was not in uniform, although he took some snaps with the quarterbacks during individual drills. Running back LeSean Williams was in a boot because of a typical football injury, but that was nothing serious. Wide receiver Alex Mota was in a boot and using a scooter to get around Duke Slater Field. Offensive line shuffle. The injuries to Jones and Dunker led to a slight rearranging of the offensive line. Mason Richmond was unsurprisingly at left tackle, and Connor Colby was unsurprisingly at right guard. Tyler Ellsbury replaced Jones at guard, as he did last season when Jones injured his ankle. Bo Stevens stepped in at left guard, where he played 51 snaps last year, per Pro Football Focus, in place of the since-graduated Rusty Feth. Nick DeJong, who played at four positions on the line last year, was Iowa's first-team right tackle in Dunker's absence. The defensive line often got the better of the offensive line on Saturday, frequently stuffing rushing attempts behind the line of scrimmage, although the offense also broke out for a few big runs. Replacing Cooper DeJean. You're not going to replace him, Ferentz said of the projected first-round pick in the NFL draft. I don't think there are any first-rounders coming up. Not at this point. At least they won't be first-rounders next fall. Deshaun Lee, John Nestor, and T.J. Hall appear to be the top three options to replace DeJean. Hall is a junior, Lee is a sophomore, and Nestor is a redshirt freshman. The good news is I think all three of those guys made strides, Ferentz said. We feel better about all three of them after 15 practices. Hilson opening eyes. Iowa defensive back Devin Hilson had, as Wood described, like a career day in practice on Thursday. It was fun to watch him and see him back there, Wood said this week. Saturday's practice, while not quite career day caliber, was another impressive showing for Hilson. The soon-to-be junior from Des Moines blocked a 30-yard field goal attempt by Drew Stevens. It was one of two misses for Stevens despite the windy conditions, by the way, with the other one being from 50-plus yards out. Also in sports, in the wrestling Olympic trials, Lee takes down Gilman by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette in State College, Pennsylvania. With a big takedown in the second period of a second match at a best-of-three championship series against fellow Hawkeye Thomas Gilman on Saturday, Spencer Lee pulled out three more back exposures before pinning Gilman and winning the U.S. Olympic trials in dramatic fashion. After raising his arms, before the ref officially raised his hand, Lee acknowledged with the crowd that his Olympic dreams are within reach. And after shaking the opposing coach's hand, Lee then leapt off the stage and into his mom's arms, who was leaning over from the stands to celebrate with him. If it wasn't for the Iowa Hawkeye program and their support in me, I'd probably be retired by now, Lee told reporters, referencing injuries and challenges he faced at the end of his NCAA career in 2023. Because Lee's 57-kilogram bracket is one of five Olympic weights not yet qualified for the Olympics, his U.S. trials win Saturday isn't an automatic ticket to the Summer Games. He still has to qualify in the United States at that weight in Istanbul, Turkey, on May 9th through the 12th by placing among the top three at the World Olympic Games qualifiers. After winning the first two of his best three of series against Gilman, Lee reminded reporters, "I've got work to do," and acknowledged the road to this day has been long and hard. And in the time machine, a look back at the people, places, and events in eastern Iowa, CR's old Union Depot. It was a monument to greed, Gazette decreed, by Diane Finn and Langton, correspondent. As I wrote in a November 2014 time machine, the Cedar Rapids Union Depot was a small, unattractive building that hardly suited a growing city. Plans for that first Union Depot began when the Chicago, Iowa, and Nebraska Railroad ran a rail line through Cedar Rapids in June 1859, bringing passenger service to the city 2 years before the Civil War. Expecting more railroads would be coming, leaders began looking into building a Union Depot that would serve the passengers on all railroads. In 1861, people were invited to a meeting at Daniels Hall to show their support for a large and commodious railroad depot in the central part of town, the Cedar Valley Times reported February 7th. In the meantime, rail traffic increased and railroads made do with their own depots. Negotiations began in 1866 to build a Union Depot, but the effort took some time. In April 1869, one woman passenger wrote the Cedar Rapids Times about the deplorable condition of a Cedar Rapids train station. She noted a lack of seating in the waiting room and the presence of drunks and vagrants in the crowded station. The stations needed to be upgraded, she said. The condition of ours has been a byword among the traveling public for years, and that it cannot afford decent accommodations for strangers and a waiting room for ladies is a disgrace to the community, she added. Every year we have a new excitement over an old subject, viz. The construction of a new depot, and each succeeding time we are doomed to disappointment. Finally, in 1870, the first Union Depot was built near 1st Avenue and 4th Street Southeast, then Jefferson and Iowa Avenues. It was owned by the Burlington, Cedar Rapids, and Northern, and the Chicago and Northwestern Railroads. Fire ravaged the new depot 11 years later, on May 9, 1883. Repairs began immediately, but the resulting Union Depot was considered an eyesore by the traveling public. Sentiment grew for a new station. By 1888, a new Cedar Rapids and Chicago depot was being built on the site of the old St. James Hotel on 1st Avenue, and a Milwaukee depot was planned for 2nd Avenue and 4th Street. It is hoped yet that the Union Depot proposition may be agreed to by the different roads and a depot built which would be a credit to the city, the Evening Gazette opined, but that would only happen if one of the roads would come down off a horse 16 hands high which it has mounted for the purpose of surveying the scene. Impetus built slowly, propelled in large part by the Gazette, which rarely had kind words for the old station. One story in January 1893, without regard for kind words, said, "The one thing that more than another is a foul blot on this city is the Union Railway Depot. It is an insult to the people of this bright, progressive city and a monument to the greed, avarice, and miserable management of those who stand in the way of better facilities and accommodation for the traveling public. Similar articles and Gazette cartoons appeared consistently for more than 2 years. Early in 1896, the old depot's days were numbered as the plans for new stations solidified. The new Union Depot will be a lasting ornament to the city. It is rolling in on the tide of the great public improvement for which Cedar Rapids is becoming famous in the year 96, the Gazette said. The new Union Depot opened in January 1897, but the old Union Depot still stood, tied up in a lengthy lawsuit by the heirs of the property's original owner, Nicholas B. Brown, who insisted ownership of the vacated building revert to them. In the meantime, the old depot was repurposed as a freight office and for storage. The Brown heirs' lawsuit was settled in 1901. That fall, it was announced the aging structure was to be raised to make way for a new freight office and warehouse. Fast forward 6 decades, and the Union Station that had accommodated thousands of rail passengers in Cedar Rapids met the same fate as its predecessor. Continued by some to be an eyesore, the second Union Station was raised in 1961. And that brings me to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, April 21st, 2024. I have been your reader, Sharon Faldudo, reading to you from my kitchen table in Coralville. Remember that you can access a recording of this or any other Iris recording at any time on our website, iowaradioreading.org. We do welcome your comments, and thank you for listening.